stories, U.S. President Joe Biden says he was not calling for regime change in Russia when he said his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, cannot remain in power. Yemeni government says a prisoner swap deal has been agreed with the Saudi-led coalition, including high-profile figures from the country's former government. North Korea's leader says the country will continue developing its striking capabilities, adding that Pyongyang's self-defense force, quote, cannot be bartered nor be bought. Those were the top stories. Beginning with the latest on the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, the two countries have agreed to open two humanitarian corridors to evacuate civilians from frontline areas. A senior Ukrainian official says that under the agreement, people will be allowed to leave the southern city of Mariupol by their cars. More than 3.8 million people have fled Ukraine since over a month ago. The UN says around 90% of them are women and children. Most of them have fled to neighboring Poland. The UN Human Rights Office says over 1,100 civilians have been killed and 1,800 wounded. The world body says the true casualty figures are expected to be much higher. Ukraine has expressed readiness to discuss neutrality and non-nuclear status if it is backed by security guarantees from Russia. Ukrainian president said that a deal with Russia is only possible if troops are withdrawn from Ukraine. Volodymyr Zelensky also noted that he would like an all-for-all prisoner exchange with Russia and have handed over a list. He added that Kiev wants compromise with Russia over eastern Donbass region. Zelensky said that he understands that forcing Russia completely from Ukraine is impossible and would lead to a third world war. The UN says over 1,100 civilians have been killed and 1,800 wounded in the conflict. Earlier, we discussed with political commentator Scott Bennett the Ukrainian president's readiness to discuss neutrality and non-nuclear status of his country.
I think if he has any semblance of rationality or intelligence, he has come to that conclusion, although he is a very mentally unbalanced and irrational person that is really going off the deep end in many, many respects. He's desperately trying to shame the United States and the United Kingdom into supplying weapons that and troops and anti-air defense materials that just are not going to arrive because the West and NATO does not want to engage in a suicidal war against Russia. The West knows very well that Russia's missile technology and their will to survive will far outweigh any petty commercial makeup wars that the West and NATO tries to engineer. And I think this is going to have a tremendous blowback as well as Russia begins to clean up the operation and it begins to counteract its kinetic operations with civil affairs and public relations campaigns to win the hearts and minds of the people. You're already witnessing countries like Serbia declaring their neutrality towards Russia and NATO. And that's going to be a prevailing trend, as we've discussed from the very beginning of this campaign. The emergence of neutrality as a foreign policy is going to dominate the Eastern European and post-Soviet Republic satellite countries.
U.S. President Joe Biden says he was not calling for a regime change in Russia when he said in his latest slip-up that his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin cannot remain in power. Earlier, Washington's NATO envoy said the U.S. has no policy of regime change in Russia. Julianne Smith claimed Biden's remarks were a principled human reaction to the stories he had heard from Ukrainian refugees. The White House had already stated that Biden meant to say that Putin cannot be allowed to exercise power over its neighbors or the region. The Kremlin, on the other hand, responded by saying that a Russian president is elected by the people of Russia and it's not up to Biden to decide who should be the country's president. Biden had also raised eyebrows in Poland when he suggested that U.S. troops would be sent to Ukraine. While Ukraine has rejected a planned referendum in its eastern separatist region as illegal, calling it null and void, Kyiv says Russia will grow more isolated and face an even stronger response from the international community in case of such a referendum. The head of Ukraine's Luhansk self-declared republic has said the separatist region will hold a referendum on becoming part of Russia. Leonid Pasechnik said the plebiscite would be held in the near future. Last month, Russia recognized Luhansk and Donetsk self-proclaimed republics as independent before launching a military offensive against Ukraine. Moscow claimed it was acting in defense of the separatist regions, which it said had been facing genocide in 2014. Ukraine's Black Sea Peninsula of Crimea also joined Russia after a referendum. Ukraine's intelligence chief says Russia is trying to split the country into two sections, as happened with North and South Koreas. Kirilyo Budanov says Russia is trying to create a Moscow-controlled region in Ukraine after failing to take over the whole country. He added that Ukrainian forces would soon launch guerrilla warfare against Russia. This comes as a European Research Institute says nearly half of Ukrainians aged 18 to 55 are ready to fight against Russia. According to the survey, around 47% of respondents said they would be willing to, quote, join direct military combat in fortified defense positions of the Ukrainian forces. To other news now, the Yemeni government announces a new prisoner swap deal with the Saudi-led coalition, including high-profile figures from the former government. The head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners' Affairs says the deal was agreed earlier this month under the auspices of the United Nations. Abdul Qadir al-Murtada says the swap deal includes 1,400 Ansarullah movement's prisoners in return for 823 prisoners, including the brother of the former Yemeni president Abdurrabu Mansur Hadi and former defense minister. The official said that the deal awaits an exchange of lists of prisoners on Tuesday. Meanwhile, a senior UN official in Yemen said no final deal has been reached between the two parties on the prisoner exchange lists, and discussions were ongoing. On Saturday, Yemen announced a unilateral ceasefire, declaring its readiness for a full prisoner swap. Faraz al-Najim, the manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, says the UN is just talking the talk, but not walking the walk when it comes to taking action to resolve the dire humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Take a listen, please.
And we know that since 2 years, after the war started, the United Nations said it's the worst humanitarian crisis in the whole world. And now we're going into a 7th-year anniversary. Now we're walking into the 8th year, unfortunately. And the United Nations has done nothing for the Yemeni people. The United Nations has not passed any resolutions to actually have a real, punishment to the Saudi regime and their coalition that has committed countless amounts of war crimes inside Yemen. They have violated the sovereignty of Yemen. They have blockaded Yemen from all areas. And we see that the world now is focusing and highlighting Ukraine, and the conflict's only about 30 days old. We're talking about 365 days times 7. So you can, anybody that has a calculator can calculate that and see how bad the situation is in Yemen. Children are dying, mothers and fathers are dying, senior citizens are dying, medical supplies are very difficult to get inside Yemen. Food supplies, the most basic necessities are hard to get inside Yemen. And the world is silent. The majority of the world is silent.
Yemen has announced a unilateral truce, suspending all retaliatory strikes against Saudi Arabia. Sana'a says it's ready for a permanent ceasefire if Saudi Arabia ends its 7-year-long war against the conflict-ridden country. The war has turned Yemen into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis. We have a report on the 7th anniversary of the Saudi war on Yemen and the latest developments on the ground.
Thousands of Yemenis have staged mass protests across the country, including the capital Sana'a, on the National Day of Resilience, the day when the Saudi-led coalition began its aggression on Yemen.
Allah Akbar, Allah Akbar, Allah Akbar, Allah Akbar.
The demonstrators marked the 7th anniversary of the Saudi-led war on their country, denounced the aggression, and expressed their support for resistance against the Saudi-led invasion. The demonstrations followed a wave of retaliatory drone and missile attacks that hit targets across Saudi Arabia.
In response to the ongoing unjust siege on our country and our people, the Yemen Armed Forces underwent the third breaking siege operation through ballistic missiles and drones in the following manner. We targeted Aramco facilities in Jeddah and other locations in the capital of our Saudi enemy, Riyadh.
Facilities belonging to the Saudi state oil company, Aramco, were also hit in Jizan and Najran in the south. The Yemeni army also says it launched drone attacks against oil refineries in the east of the kingdom. According to the army, multiple vital targets in several other locations, including in Abha in Asir region, have also been hit by ballistic missiles. This is the Yemeni army's highest profile attack yet on the kingdom. The army vowed to continue the retaliatory military operations until Riyadh stops its years-long aggression and lifts its all-out siege on Yemen. Retaliatory missile and drone strikes against oil storage facilities in Saudi Arabia rekindled concerns over supply shortages as crude oil prices surged and broke the $120 level. The news added fuel to the already volatile oil market, shadowed by supply risks related to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia has launched a series of attacks against Yemen, targeting the country's facilities in the provinces of Hodeidah and Sana'a, killing at least 8 people. The coalition has hit oil facilities in Hodeidah. That violates a 2018 ceasefire deal that ended months of fighting in the city, which handles about 70% of Yemen's commercial and humanitarian imports. The air raids also hit the nearby Port Salif, also on the Red Sea. Saudi Arabia's warmongering policies in Yemen have so far killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, injured tens of thousands, and displaced millions. However, the war has stopped well shy of its goals, as the Yemeni army is gaining momentum by striking a heavy blow against the Riyadh regime. It's high time Saudis realize that they are on the losing side of the war, one in which militarily they are defeated while endangering their jewel, Aramco.
Certainly, they are losing this war. The Yemeni government, the Yemeni military is growing in strength since the beginning of the war. They are developing their own weapons and also relying on their allies to provide them with weapons. This recent strike was very targeted, very calculated, and was a big surprise to Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia accuses the Yemeni army and the popular Ansar resistance movement of rejecting peace efforts, this as the kingdom itself is the main culprit of all hardship inflicted on the Yemeni people as the years-long war continues. The Saudi war has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemeni civilians and destroyed more than 85% of Yemen's infrastructure, causing food and medicine crisis. Now, Yemen is calling for a permanent ceasefire, urging Riyadh to stop the devastating war. But what are the Sana'a's government's conditions for reaching a ceasefire?
Yemen has announced a 3-day unilateral ceasefire suspending all rocket and drone attacks against Saudi Arabia, affirming its readiness to turn the declaration into a permanent commitment.
We announce the cessation of offensive confrontations on all field fronts for a period of 3 days, and we affirm our readiness to turn this suspension into a final, continuous, and permanent commitment in the event that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia announces the withdrawal of all foreign forces of the coalition from our Yemeni lands and waters, and a complete stop of its support to local militias in our country.
Meshaat said Saudi Arabia must end its blockade on the Republic of Yemen once and for all. He said Yemen is also ready to perform a full prisoner exchange. He called on the UN Special Envoy for Yemen to take steps to prepare the agreements to carry out the exchanges. Following Meshaat's declaration, the spokesman for Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Mohammed Abdul Salam, took to Twitter, urging Saudi Arabia to show a positive reaction to the announcement and prove that it's serious about peace. Meanwhile, the head of Yemen's negotiating team says Riyadh must prove its seriousness in response to Yemeni peace plan by responding to the ceasefire, lifting the siege, and withdrawing troops. The leader of the popular Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, has condemned the international community for remaining silent in the face of what he called Saudi crimes against the Yemeni people.
The United States should be supporting the people of Yemen in this war of aggression against them. But instead, it is supporting the very powerful Saudi government. And it is, as you said, providing bombs, other weaponry, logistics, all kinds of aid to Saudi Arabia in their brutal and illegal war of aggression against the people of Yemen.
It has been around a month since the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and the West has shown unabated support for Kyiv by denouncing Moscow's actions, providing military equipment for Ukraine, and the biased coverage of the war by Western media. Conversely, Western nations have seemingly forgotten that Yemen is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, one that the US and several Western states have contributed to its making by providing arms and logistic support for the Saudi-led coalition.
North Korea's leader says the country will continue to develop, quote, formidable striking capabilities and build a stronger strategic force. Kim Jong-un made the comment as he visited workers involved in the country's biggest missile test. He was meeting with scientists and technicians who contributed to a missile launch on Thursday, which Pyongyang said was its largest intercontinental ballistic missile. Kim said the country's self-defense force, quote, cannot be bartered nor be bought with anything. The U.S. has slapped new sanctions on North Korea over its nuclear and missile programs. Washington has also imposed sanctions on a number of Russian individuals and entities accusing him of providing sensitive materials to North Korea's missile program. Two Palestinians carry out a shooting attack in the city of Hadera in the occupied Palestinian territories before being gunned down by Israeli security forces. Surveillance camera footage showed two men opening fire with assault rifles on a main street in Hadera. Two Israeli security forces were killed in the attack and four others were injured. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas hailed the attack in Hadera as a, quote, heroic operation. The movement said such attacks are a natural and legitimate response to the Israeli occupation and its crimes against Palestinians. The Islamic Jihad movement also said the attack was a response to a meeting between Israel, U.S., and foreign ministers of four Arab countries, which is to be held on Monday in occupied Palestine. And that does it for now. Many thanks.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Facebook's involvement in the Zionist regime's efforts aimed at silencing Palestinian online voices that call for justice, freedom, and end of the occupation is itself situated in an agreement the company had reached with the regime in September 2016, says Ramzi Baru, journalist and the editor of the Palestine Chronicle, in an article published under the heading How the Zionist Regime's Facebook Law Plans to Control All Palestinian Content Online. Stay tuned for more. It is ironic that even former right-wing Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had rejected a Knesset bill which proposed to give the regime greater power to control and suppress online content. This was in 2016. The bill was introduced by Netanyahu's Likud party rival, Gideon Saar. Some analysts argued that Netanyahu had feared that a law aimed at suppressing Palestinian freedom of speech online could be exploited by his enemies to control his own speech and incitement. Now that Netanyahu is no longer in the picture, the bill is back, and so is Saar. Gideon Saar is currently the Zionist regime's so-called justice minister and deputy prime minister. While his boss Naftali Bennett is moving rapidly to expand settlements and to worsen already horrific realities for Palestinians on the ground, Saar is expanding the Zionist regime's military occupation of Palestinians to the digital realm. What is known as the Facebook Law is set to grant the Zionist regime courts the power to demand the removal of user-generated content on social media content platforms that can be perceived as inflammatory or as harming the security of the regime, or the security of people, or the security of the public. According to a December 30 statement by the Palestinian Digital Rights Coalition, PDRC, and the Palestinian Human Rights Organizations Council, PHROC, the Zionist regime's censorship of Palestinian content online has deepened since 2016, when Saar's bill was first introduced. In their statement, the two organizations highlighted the fact that the Zionist regime's so-called cyber unit had submitted 2,421 requests to social media companies to delete Palestinian content in 2016. That number has grown exponentially since, to the extent that the cyber unit alone has requested the removal of more than 20,000 Palestinian items. PDRC and PHROC suggest that the new legislation, which was already approved by the Ministerial Committee for Legislation on December 27th, would only strengthen the relationship between the cyber unit and social media companies. Unfortunately, that relationship is already strong, at least with Facebook, which routinely censors Palestinian content and has been heavily criticized by Human Rights Watch and other organizations. After examining the numerous allegations of Facebook censorship, Deborah Brown, the senior digital rights researcher and advocate at HRW, concluded that Facebook has suppressed content posted by Palestinians and their supporters speaking out about human rights issues in Palestine. Facebook's involvement in the Zionist regime's efforts aimed at silencing Palestinian online voices that call for justice, freedom, and end of the occupation is itself situated in an agreement that the company had reached with the Zionist regime in September 2016. Then the Zionist regime announced that it had signed an agreement with the social media giant to work together to determine how to tackle incitement on the social media network. Within days, the accounts of prominent Palestinian journalists and activists were reportedly being deleted. The Zionist regime's latest Facebook law does not just pertain to controlling content on Facebook-related platforms, including Instagram and others. According to a Haaretz editorial published on December 29th, the impact of this particular bill is far-reaching, as it will grant district court judges throughout the country the power to remove posts not only from Facebook and other social media outlets, but from any website at all. Unsurprisingly, the Zionist regime's censorship of Palestinian content is justified under the typical pretense of protecting the Zionist regime's national security. We all know how the Zionist regime interprets this elusive concept to include anything from a Palestinian calling for the Zionist regime to be held accountable for its crimes in the occupied territories to another demanding the end of the Israeli apartheid to a third writing a poem. A case in point was the humiliating imprisonment of Palestinian poet Darin Tatur. The latter, an Israeli citizen, was thrown in jail in 2015 per court order for writing a short poem entitled "Resist, My People, Resist Them." Judging from past experience, undoubtedly, the Facebook law would almost exclusively target Palestinians. Moreover, judging from the Zionist regime's previous successes, many digital and social media companies would comply with the Zionist regime's demands of censoring Palestinians everywhere. In January 11th report, the Arab Center for Social Media Advancement, Hamle, detailed some of the practices that the Zionist regime engages in to monitor, silence, and spy on Palestinians. Hamle's report, entitled #Palestine2021, discusses the increased use of surveillance technologies, especially in the context of a proposed Zionist regime law that would expand the use of facial recognition cameras in public spaces. It is worth noting that such technologies have already been used against Palestinians at the Zionist regime's military checkpoints throughout the West Bank for at least 2 years. Moreover, the Zionist regime's Pegasus spyware, which has recently made headlines throughout the world for its use against numerous high-profile figures, has also long been used against Palestinian activists. In other words, Palestine continues to be the testing ground for the Zionist regime's violations of all kinds, whether in new weaponry, crowd control, or surveillance. Expectedly, what applies to Palestinians demanding their freedom online does not apply to Israelis inciting violence and spreading hatred against those very Palestinians. According to the Hamle Index of Racism and Incitement, published last June, during the Zionist regime's war on the besieged Gaza Strip and the subsequent anti-Palestinian violence throughout Palestine in May 2021, incitement in Hebrew against Arabs and Palestinians increased by 15 times if compared to the same period of the last year. Much of this has gone unnoticed, and it is hardly the subject of the proposed Facebook law or the sinister activities of the cyber unit. For Gideon Sa'ar and his ilk, anti-Palestinian incitement, along with the daily violence meted out against the occupied Palestinians, is a non-issue. While the Zionist regime is permitted, thanks to the deafening silence of the international community, to maintain its military occupation of Palestine, to cement its apartheid, and to deepen its control of Palestinian life everywhere, it should not be permitted to expand this matrix of control to the digital realm as well. Civil society organizations, activists, and ordinary people everywhere must speak out to bring an end to this mockery. Moreover, as the Pegasus and the facial recognition surveillance technologies experiences have taught us, what is usually first applied to Palestinians is eventually normalized and applied everywhere else. The Zionist regime should therefore be confronted in its abuses of human rights in Palestine, because these abuses, if normalized, will become a part of our daily lives regardless of where we are in the world.
Food for thought.
Salam, everybody, and let us listen to a saying from the martyr of Karbala, the Prophet's younger grandson, Imam Hussein, peace upon him, about the savior of humanity. The ninth of my descendants is the Imam who will rise with the truth. God will grant life to the earth through him after its death. The true faith will supersede all religions through him. His absence shall be lengthy, during which many people go astray. Only a few will remain on the right path. They shall suffer pains. People will put pressure on them, saying, "Let us know when this promise of the return of the Mahdi is fulfilled." Those who will bear the pains and denials patiently will get the same rewards as those who accompanied the Prophet during his expeditions for jihad.
Congratulations to everyone at the start of spring and revival of nature. Happy Iranian New Year!
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program for humanity. We are looking at justice from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi al-salam, which is found at least in the letter that he wrote for one of his commanders, Malik al-Ashtar. Now, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullahi alayhi, among the things that he said to Malik, he said to him, "Remember that people are composed of different classes." Well, obviously, that's a very important fact that needs to be taken into consideration. And that is when we deal with people. We have to keep in mind we have different classes, meaning there are different types of people, not classes in terms of the wealthy and the poor, or those who are in higher status and those who are in lower status. No, rather different jobs and different positions and different professions. And that's something have to be highlighted. When we look at people, we have to keep in mind that as human beings, we are created as social, civilized creatures. We are not created as cavemen or as people who live in the forest or in the deserts, who are not Bedouins. We need one another to exist. As much as I need a doctor needs a bradesman. A doctor needs a blacksmith. A blacksmith will need a police officer. A police officer will need, I don't know, someone else. So those classes need to be taken into consideration. So he says to him, he says to Malik, that when you deal with people, you have to make sure that this is maintained. For example, he says to him the progress of one is dependent on the progress of every other, which is very true. And none can afford to be independent of their own. I, as a person, cannot try to provide for myself in everything. I cannot heal myself when I'm sick. I cannot build for myself when I need to build a house. I cannot grow crops if I need to feed myself. All these things I am dependent on other people to do. And people at the same time, they might be dependent on a skill that I have as well. So we, at the end of the day, we all need one another. And the fact is, since we have different classes, then each of that class, each of profession, they have specific rights and duties that they must be given to them, especially when we're trying to apply the concept of justice. Because at the end of the day, justice means that you have to give everyone their rights. And some people might require more than other people. Not being equal. Being equal is one thing. Applying justice is another. So Amir al-Mu'mineen trying to bring that to the mind of Malik, which in reality, he's bringing that to us, all of us. He's bringing that to all of us because he's not just talking to Malik. He's talking to everyone that reads this letter. Let us take a short break and then we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity, coming to you from IRIB English Radio. Just before the break, we were saying that Amir al-Mu'mineen was telling Malik to keep in mind that there are different classes of people. So he says to him, we have the army formed of the soldiers of God. Now, obviously, considering that the country is a Muslim country and there are Muslims and they're trying to defend their land, we have our civil officers and their establishments, our judiciary, our revenue collectors, the tax collectors, and our public relation officers. So those are just different groups of people, different classes of government that Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah Ali is highlighting and mentioning to Malik al-Ashtar Radwanullahi Alayh. And then he says to him, even the Muslims themselves, they consist of Muslims and as what we call dhimmi, those who are non-Muslims, but they have given an oath that they would live and under Islamic system and pay their taxes and not to cause any harm or any problems to Muslims. So Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah Alayhi, he says to Malik, keep those people in mind. And he says to him, amongst those people are merchants and craftsmen, that and the unemployed and the indigent. And he says to him, God has prescribed for them their several rights, duties, and obligations. They are all defined and preserved in the Quran and in the traditions and the hadith of the Holy Prophet. Now, obviously, the simple matter is that Amir al-Mu'mineen is saying to Malik that all these groups, all these classes, they have rights, duties, and obligations. They take and they have to give. And where do we find these rights and these duties and obligations? Do I make them as I see fit? Do the government make it as they see fit? Does the constitution says how things should be run when it comes to these classes? Or who should tell us? Well, obviously, from the words of Amir al-Mu'mineen. He says, this case, this task, is not a task for man. Rather, it is a task for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So we find these things in the words of the Quran, in the instructions of the Quran, and in the tradition and the hadith of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Then Amir al-Mu'mineen goes on to explain how these different types of classes play a major role in trying to protect the society. Example, he talks about the armies. An army, he says, is a fortress that helps and protects the people. So people, me and you, we need the military defense system. We need our protection. We need to feel secure and safe. That's just our natural basic right that has to be provided by the governments. Governments should not seek power to destroy other nations or to flex their muscles against other nations. Rather, they should use their power and they should develop their armies in order to protect their own members, their own citizens, the common people. And that's just the basic right. So Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, he highlights that fact to Malik, that when you look at people, you have different classes, and each requires a certain right and a certain privilege and they have certain duties and certain obligations. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله اللهم صل على محمد وآله
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Hello everyone, welcome to the light. It's good to have you with us. Asia's largest tulip garden has opened its door to visitors in the Indian-controlled Kashmir 2 years after continued closure due to the outbreak of the COVID-19. Shahana Bhatt reports.
On the banks of Kashmir's famous Dal Lake, surrounded by the majestic Zabarwan mountain range, Asia's largest tulip garden opens for visitors. 1.5 million flowers of 68 varieties have vibrantly colored the earth.
This is heaven and this place is beyond imagination. After facing lockdown for 2 years, this place is a treat.
Whatever is said in the media and shown is not the truth. The truth is, it is the most secure place to visit.
Kashmir is witnessing bumper tourist season this spring after COVID-19 pandemic lockdown. Administration as well as people expect a bumper tourist season.
We are trying our best, and this year we are lucky in terms of early spring, so that people of Kashmir will have an economic boost.
Following the coronavirus pandemic, the tourists stopped visiting Kashmir, and last 2 years, Kashmir's economy faced a major setback.
Tourism is our backbone of our economy. The money they pump in our economy is manifold for our economy. So that's why our tourist, this tulip garden, it gives impetus to our tourist season. It prepones our tourist season. We have seen the initial response from tourists, particularly from outside UT. We are hoping that this season will be a great season for our tourism sector.
To reclaim the fractured economy, Kashmir's administration has organized a tulip festival to attract more tourists and locals so that the lockdown impact vanishes slowly to conflict-wrecked Kashmir.
After 2.5 years of continued closure due to COVID-19 pandemic, the opening of this garden has brought delight to the people of Kashmir, who for decades have suffered political instability and turmoil. Opening of such spaces help boost morale and is a good start to a fresh year. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
If you're an avid fan of traveling, check out this story. A Belgian-British teenager is on a solo flight around the globe that could make him a world record holder. Mac Rutherford started his journey from a small airfield near the Bulgarian capital Sofia on Wednesday. His first destination, the island of Sicily in Italy. From there, he will fly to South Africa and then around the globe to cross the finishing line again in Bulgaria. The 16-year-old pilot says he got his inspiration from his sister.
You know, I wanted to do something special in my aviation career, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. It's only once my sister flew around the world that I knew I also wanted to fly around the world.
Mac was born in a family of aviators. His sister Zora became the youngest female pilot to fly solo around the world in a small plane last year. Before setting off on his exciting journey, the young man was seen off by his mother, friends, and sister. If successful, Mac would claim the Guinness World Record as the youngest person who has flown the world solo. He has scheduled to wrap up his journey in July. Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, is celebrated worldwide by millions of people, including the people in Indian-controlled Kashmir. The region, known for its natural beauty worldwide, turns magical each year during its spring season. To mark nature's revival, the people of Kashmir have dedicated a day to thank the mesmerizing beauty of spring. Our correspondent Shahana Bhatt reports.
As the spring season begins in Kashmir, the earth turns lush green and the trees bear colorful blossoms, with the sky visibly blue and waters clear and glossy. After a not-so-harsh winter this year, the people of Kashmir are welcoming the onset of spring. Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, marks the beginning of spring and is celebrated on March 21st. New trees are planted while people offer prayers and seek God's help for a prosperous year.
Each year, we await this season so that we can plant new trees. The process of their growth gives us hope, and that hope teaches us that God has set a time for everything. We can't fast-track it. We can only do our best efforts.
On the occasion of Nowruz, women in Kashmir prepare unique dishes made from lotus stem and fish. Mehra and her sister have a busy day today. Friends and family are invited to relish the moment.
We have been taught by our mothers and grandmothers to cook these delicacies on the special occasion of Nowruz. It requires lots of dedication, and what matters is that this food brings friends and families together, and a lot of positive energy is exchanged. For us, Nowruz is not just an occasion, but it marks a fresh beginning of love, growth, and prosperity.
On the occasion of Nowruz, the Kashmiri administration often organizes musical festivals to add fervor to the celebrations. People, especially children, visit these musical festivals in large numbers so that the year starts with cheerful memories. This year, scores of tourists have also come to witness Kashmir's spring.
We had heard that Kashmir looks magical, but we witnessed in reality that this land looks fabulous, especially the spring season.
The early arrival of tourists has added a lot of positivity to Kashmir's tourism sector, which has been hit hard by years of political instability and turmoil. Persian culture is deeply rooted in Kashmir, and celebrating Nowruz is a sign of its influence.
Nowruz marks a new beginning, and after suffering decades of political instability and 2 years of the COVID pandemic, people are only hoping for a return back to a normal life and an everlasting peace. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Egypt's rich history seems to be a gift that keeps on giving. The country has unveiled some exquisite newly discovered tombs. The pharaonic tombs were found at the Saqqara archaeological site south of Cairo. The site is a big necropolis of Memphis, an ancient capital of Egypt. The graves belonged to a senior royal official, or rather senior royal officials. Some of the graves are engraved with interesting titles such as Steward of the Royal House and Supervisor of the Garden. The tombs are around 4,000 years old, dating back to the Old Kingdom of Egypt. Turkey inaugurates the world's longest suspension bridge over the Dardanelles Strait. The bridge is more than 2 kilometers long and connects Turkey's European and Asian shores. It cuts travel time between the two locations to just 6 minutes. A consortium of Turkish and South Korean firms began constructing the huge bridge in 2017 with a budget of 2.5 billion euros. 5,000 workers participated in the colossal undertaking. Passenger vehicles must pay a fare of 200 Turkish liras or around 14 US dollars to use the bridge. In Peru, paleontologists have unearthed the skull of a ferocious marine predator that is an ancestor of the modern-day whale. The 36-million-year-old skull was dug up intact after it was discovered in Peru's southern desert. The fossil belongs to an ancient mammal whose contemporary descendants include dolphins. Recreations of how the animal looked like show it mostly resembles a giant lizard that moved like a snake. Paleontologists say it was a top predator measuring some 12 meters long.
The discovery is very important because the skull is in a perfect state of preservation. The skull and the jaw are in the right anatomical position. The teeth are complete. It's very possible this might be a new Basilosaurus species. If this is so, there is no other fossil like this one anywhere else in the world.
Salas further explained when the ancient animal died, its skull might have sunk to the bottom of the seafloor, where it was quickly preserved. The skull, measuring 1.3 meters long, was unveiled at Lima's Museum of Natural History. The Peruvian desert is rich in fossils and offers scientists 42 million years' worth of evolutionary evidence. Other fossils found there include the four-legged dwarf whale and sharks, among others.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A painter in Pakistan shifts from trucks to trainers to uncover a hip new canvas for his famous truck art. Haydar Ali says he works on each pair of shoes for up to 4 days, and his paint of choice is mainly acrylic. He also uses other forms of durable material such as oil paint to get the job done. The seasoned artist charges select clients $400 for each set. His designs feature intricate bespoke patterns including flowers, peacocks, and wildly colorful motifs. He says new requests typically arrive every 4 days. Orders for painted trainers started pouring in for the truck artist after a surge of social media interest.
Ideas keep popping up for me, and sometimes clients have ideas. A client came to me from the US asking for a painting on some shoes. I told him an exorbitant fee to discourage him, but he agreed, so I decided, let's do it then.
He has dispatched 8 pairs to various places in Pakistan and abroad since he first started painting trainers in January. Ali comes from a family of truck artists who made a living off of painting lorries. He came to international fame when his work was exhibited at a museum in the U.S. 2 decades ago. So far, the veteran truck artist has applied his craft to an airplane as well as a passenger car, among others. The art form is mainly seen on Pakistani trucks, and today, the trade is one of the country's most famous cultural exports.
Archaeologists have discovered a 500-year-old Aztec altar with 164 in Mexico City, Mexico's largest starfish offering discovered to date. Archaeologists believe it was built around the year 1500. Jaguar bones and other remains such as sea shells were also found. Scientists believe the fossils found correspond to a species known as chocolate chip sea star or Nidorella armata.
This is really interesting because if you think about it, chocolate chip sea star looks like the skin of a jaguar. It's orange with dark spots. Probably that is why this species was selected, but we still need to analyze all the starfish because we found 160 of them and we think they all belong to the same species. But we need to research further every one of them.
According to experts, the location of the altar within the Templo Mayor complex and the jaguar motifs suggest the offering was related to the war. Mexico is brimmed with archaeological sites of several civilizations, including Aztecs. Retired racehorses could be retrained for a new role as so-called therapy horses. According to a study led by the University of Bristol, veterans and disabled children, as well as those struggling with mental health issues, can benefit from the therapy horses. The three-year study aims to provide a global standard for the racing industry and a toolkit for retraining racehorses. A racehorse's career can last anywhere between 2 and 10 years, but better could be done to make use of these beautiful creatures soon after they're retired.
So racehorses, when they finish their racing careers, and they can finish as young as sort of 3 or 4 years old, they really don't want to be just standing around in fields for the next 20, 30 years. And they're so versatile that I really believe there's a job for 99% of them. I think there's almost a sixth sense with the horse. People needing therapy, whether that's mental health or physical disabilities, there seems to be sort of something that gels between a horse and a human.
Horse trainers say with the thoroughbred's lifespan between 25 to 30 years, this study's aim is crucial for their long-term welfare. Over 7,000 racehorses end their career every year in Britain, with many going into eventing and pleasure riding.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
There will be no prosecution of Saudi Arabian rulers for their war crimes committed in Yemen or for the U.S. military and political leadership for the war crimes they carried out in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and Libya, or a generation earlier in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, says Chris Hedges, journalist, in an article published under the heading War Crimes and the Lie of American Innocence. Stay tuned.